This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you decided to join us today. One of my favorite things about poetry is the way it opens up language and ideas, the way, as an art form, it can draw so strongly from other art forms to really shine and soar. The best poets, for me, blend the virtues of music and literature, of rhythm and political ideology, of emotion and even journalism, and give you something that celebrates those things equally, but that itself ends up with no real equal. That's the reason I've been such a fan of Tyemba Jess for such a long time. He's someone who does a lot of interpreting and playing around with the messier spaces of the human condition. He thinks a lot about the complexity, the beauty, and the tragedy, and the struggle that Americans experienced in the past. He is a native Detroiter. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and I'm proud to say he is also a graduate of the same high school that I attended, University of Detroit Jesuit High School and Academy. In Jess's book, Olio, he uses music, artistic symbols, and different characters to bring to life more fully what America was like around the Civil War era up until World War I. He is speaking this weekend at the Midwest Literary Walk, and I'm really grateful to have him here with us to talk about what influences his work, how he got into poetry, and what he makes of the various ways that history bleeds into the present. Tyemba Jess, welcome to Detroit Today.
Mr. Henderson, it's really, really an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me into your studio.
Yes. So, teacher we had in common at U of D High, Father Polakowski.
Father Polo. Yes, Polakowski.
Would scold me if I didn't start out talking about that commonality. You and I are both graduates of U of D High. I think you graduated when I was in the eighth grade there. I want to start right there. Talk about growing up here in Detroit. Talk about U of D Jesuit and how it all influenced the things that you were going to do later in life.
Well, you know, to take it way, way back, yeah, actually one of my first poetry writing experiences was waking up, and I wrote a poem about the city of Detroit. I remember writing, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I scribbled it down. I took it to Father Polo. And he looked it over. I don't exactly remember what he said about it, but I remember I was probably one of my first cracks at revision. And then I later on took that poem and entered it into an AXO competition, the NAACP Academic Olympics competition. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was 18, just about to go to college at the University of Chicago, and I won the second prize. Huh. And Dudley Randall was actually one of the judges. I did not know Dudley Randall at the time, but it was part of a little fuel that Detroit gave me. So much of my inspiration came from being in this wonderful city and seeing the wonders of creativity from Detroit. Yeah. And taking that energy out into the world.
So that's such an interesting story, in the sense that you said you just woke up and had this idea, but that the vehicle for you was poetry. Why do you think that was?
You know, I'm not really sure why. I actually wanted to go into journalism, but it seemed like there were just too many deadlines attached to it. Poems, you can kind of let them sit and simmer for, you know, for 20 minutes or 20 months. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be more suited to my timeline. But I'm also a bit of a narrative poet. I like to tell stories. So I kind of do journalism from the past into the present.
Yeah.
And I do it through poetry. And poetry is a great vehicle for that. It fits in little tiny spaces. You can deliver it quickly, get in, get out, and get into somebody's consciousness you know, lay something down and then let them work with that.
Yeah. So as I was saying in the open, you know, one of the things I love about poetry is the way that it sort of stands on the shoulders often of these other art forms. It kind of borrows from them. And when I'm reading your work, it's also vivid, the other influences, music and rhythm, this idea of even literature and emotion. I'm always curious for poets how you make sense of all of that in this other art form, right? You're taking from these others, you're borrowing elements of these others and creating something really new and really exciting.
Well, you know, I think another aspect of this is a lot of research. I do a lot of research into the people that I write about. So I try my best to understand as much as I can about the people that I write about, because I write about historical figures quite a bit, and I figure I owe it to them to try and get their story as straight as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, I also am learning about their art form. So in this book, Olio, there's musicians, there's classical musicians, mm-hmm. there's comedians, there's sculptors. You know, so it means when I'm researching them, I have to research about their craft.
Yeah.
And in doing so, I try to bring some of the language of that many times into the poem and to try and see it from their perspective.
Yeah. Your first book, Lead Belly, is a historical work. It is about a blues musician. Tell me a little more about what made you interested in that musician and that work.
Right. It's Lead Belly was the nickname for Hoodie Ledbetter. And Mr. Ledbetter was born in Louisiana around mid-1880s and died in New York in 1949, knew about 500 songs off the top of his head, went to prison twice, once for shooting a man over a woman, once for stabbing a man over a song, sang his way out of prison once. Now, if that's not a narrative
that's worthy of poetry, I don't know what is.
He also lies at the crux of our nation's understanding of folk music and blues. So he was a fascinating individual who really believed in his art and used his art to change his life. And that is a lot of what I was really actually trying to do with my own art, my own art form. And so I found a kind of commonality in studying his life very carefully and trying to understand where he was coming from in the early part of the 20th century. In the really early part of the 21st century.
You said he sank his way out of prison. How did
he
do that?
It's an interesting story. Well, it didn't like he sank his way out of prison, but what happened was he was in prison, and the governor of Texas liked to bring his parties down to the. It's a true story. He used to like to bring parties down to the prison and have the prisoners entertain him, and at one point Lead Belly said, I'm going to sing a song to the governor and ask for a pardon. Now, he was called the king of the 12-string guitar for good reason. He was extremely talented. You can go, folks, I really urge you to go and look up his work, but he was really just a great guitarist, and he did perform for the governor, and the governor did give him an early release.
Because of the song.
Yeah.
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 Oh, that's very cool. I'm talking with Tayemba Jess. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning poet and author of the book Olio. He's also a Detroit native and will be one of the speakers at the Midwest Literary Walk this weekend in Chelsea. One of my favorite events every year. We always get really great folks to come from all over the world, really, to be part of the Literary Walk. It's really great also to celebrate folks who are our own, folks who are from here in Southeast Michigan. If you want to participate in the conversation, have a conversation with Tayemba, give us a call. Let us know what your knowledge is of poetry. What is your knowledge of American history or the Civil War period up to World War I? How is your understanding changed of that era over time. Also, if you're just a fan of poetry and want to talk about how it comes together and how it inspires you, this is the time to do it. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. So, Diamond, I want to talk about Olio, the book for which you won the Pulitzer Prize in 2017. As I said, it focuses on America from the Civil War up to World War I. Talk about your fascination with that time period.
Well, you know, after writing about Leadbelly, who was born in 1885, I really became curious about, well, who were his musical influences? Who were the black musicians creating music before the era of recording?
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing research, and it was, you know, we were just doing amazing, fascinating things after the Civil War, like directly after the Civil War. I started running across all these just amazing stories to me that, frankly, I wish I had learned. I felt like I should have learned them in grade school, in high school. And so I felt an obligation in a certain kind of way, and also really, frankly, an opportunity to bring them to the page as well as I could possibly understand how to bring them to the page. So Olio means the middle part of a minstrel show,
mm-hmm.
in which a group of acts come together and create a variety show, so to speak. And in this book, there are a host of black creatives who are telling their story, and the backdrop of these black creatives trying to create art through integrity is the shadow of the minstrel show, which is more or less a white supremacist form of psychological warfare that was really the primary form of American entertainment throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries. So they're kind of in a tussle,
yeah.
so to speak, with this overarching art form, trying to create their own art with their own impetus, their own vision inside it to escape the idea of caricature and fully realize their humanity.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people might have been interested in that subject and just written a book, right? A fiction work or a nonfiction work. Tell me why this works for you as a collection of poems.
Well, you know, first, that calls me to bring a commercial for poetry, which is to say that there is no good writing without poetry in it.
wow.
Poetry has the ability to say the most with the least amount of words.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called economy, compression. And I feel that I wanted to bring to life their voices, because they're mostly persona poems, meaning they're poems
in the voice of the
imaginary voice of these people. So it's an attempt to bring, when you speak in first person, which is what these poems basically are, you kind of bring the reader really back deep into that actual moment, and they start to come closer to understanding the positionality of the speaker.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Tayamba Jess. Also, have him read a little from his book, Olio. Also, get to you on the phones and on social. How do you use poetry in your life? Are you a poet who is looking for a way to sort of explore that deeper? Maybe just getting into it. How does poetry help you navigate the world? Is it something that you turn to in times where you need inspiration or support? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll include you that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. We've got a really great guest right now. Tayemba Jest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and the author of the book Olio. He's also a Detroit native and is going to be a speaker at the Midwest Literary Walk this weekend in Chelsea. We're talking about his work. We're talking about growing up here in Detroit. We're talking about poetry and the role it plays in our lives, whether we're people who write poems or people who just enjoy them. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Give us a call and let us know what role poetry plays in your life. Are you somebody who is a poet? So many poets here in Detroit, so many great poetry organizations really here in Detroit. Inside Out is one of my favorites, and I always am so moved by the poems that the really young people in that organization come up with. Call and let us know how you make poetry fit, I guess, into your life and what it does for you, what role it plays for you in the world. 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Tayemba, I do want to have you read a little from Olio, and the first poem I'd like to read is on page 15. It's called Blind Tom Plays for Confederate Troops, 1863. You use and reference music, again, a lot in your poetry, and you seem to write, again, from these very first person voices. So I want to have you read and then talk a little about Blind Tom and who he's meant to be.
Right. Well, why not? Can I talk about him first?
Sure, you can talk about him.
Well, Blind Tom was born autistic and blind in about 1849. He was born into slavery in Georgia. And to put it shortly, the family upon whose plantation he was born, the family that owned the plantation, the Bethune family, controlled him throughout his life up until the Civil War, and then past that, really for his entire life. And he had a phonographic memory. He became very popular throughout the American South and around the world, really, and as a result, they made about $1 million in profit off of Blind Tom throughout his life. And this is taken from a time when they took him around playing for, well, exactly what the title says, Blind Tom Plays for Confederate Troops, 1863. The slave's hands dance free, unfettered, flying across ivory, feet stomping toward a crescendo that fills the forest pine, reminding the rebs what they're fighting for, black captive labor. Tom, slick with sweat, shows a new trick. Back turned to his piano, he leans like a runner about to throw himself to freedom through forest bramble, until he spreads his hands behind him. He hitches fingertips to keys, hauls Dixie slowly out of the battered upright's teeth like a work song, dragged across cotton fields. Like a plow, weighted and dirty, ringing with a slaver's songs at master's bidding.
Wow. So even as you're reading that, I mean, I can hear the influences of music and rhythm in the way that it's paced and phrased, that, again, that overlap of art forms. And again, the vivid imagery of of someone who certainly in his time was not thought to be a full human being and not given the dignity of voice. But here, it's all about him.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's part of what we can do in poetry, and part of what's happening in literature, and also in the iconography of the whole country. All over the country, you see statues being replaced or taken down to try and create a re-understanding of what our history is and what it means to us. And in literature, the same thing is happening. There's so many poets that are going back and excavating the past and trying to re-understand or come to a kind of a remix, so to speak, of what actually has happened in our history.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little about process. So you discover this story about Blind Tom. Talk about the path from that to this amazing poem that gives him it gives him personage. It gives him this idea of life.
Right. Well, this poem is a sonnet. S-O-N-N-E-T, mm-hmm. And it's actually part of a crown of sonnets that's in the book. It's one of several. And it's actually, Blind Tom is a great, is really where the book started, because he just posed an intriguing figure. And here's this man who's blind, autistic, but extremely talented. Has an extreme talent that blossoms on the keyboard, and he harnesses it in a certain way, in that his behavior is really kind of out of the ordinary. Like the family has to accommodate him in certain ways in order to get him to play, but at the same time, they take the fruits of his labor and really and profit from it tremendously. There's so many contradictions happening in that story, and those contradictions, that tension is what makes for, you know, makes for just a kind of something that captivated me and made me feel like it was something worthy of that I really needed to understand it and come to a fresh understanding of it myself by writing it down.
Yeah. You also write a letter to W.E.B. Du Bois, from the perspective of a made-up figure, Julius Monroe Trotter. And I wonder how much Du Bois' work influences your own, given that this is kind of the same era, right? He's right. In the same era as these figures that you're writing about.
He is. Du Bois, I mean, it's his influence on me is tremendous. In the book, there's several what I contrapuntal poems. In other words, there's poems where there's two poems that talk to each other, that read, when you read from left to right, they read into each other. And sometimes when you read from right to left, they also read into each other. They read in different ways. So they represent two different personas in conversation with each other. And that is kind of playing off the idea of double consciousness that Du Bois devised to more better understand the psychic reality of being African American, of being Black in America, where you have to exercise one kind of consciousness on your job and then another kind of consciousness in your community. So it's playing off of that, and Du Bois, you know, he was the editor of Crisis Magazine, NAACP's, which is still being published today, and it's NAACP's newsletter, so to speak. But he devised that as a kind of tool of upliftment, and I want to be in communication with that. With that, there's a guy, an imaginary person who is really obsessed with the legacy of Scott Joplin, and he's interviewing people around the country who knew Scott Joplin after he died, and he's sending these interviews back to the Crisis magazine to have them published there. According to the book, they're lost, and they're not found until very recently, in the last, I think, 2014, 2015, and then all of a sudden they surface. I wanted to be in communication, in communication kind of psychically with the legacy of W.E.B. Du Bois and Crisis Magazine, Double Consciousness, the kind of intent of further understanding, you know, because, you know, without Crisis Magazine, you know, some of our most most prominent figures of the Harlem Renaissance,
right?
Were first published.
They don't get an airing, right?
In Crisis Magazine,
yeah, right?
You know,
It was where they could publish.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So you know, it was a very critical organ, so I just kind of borrowed a little from W.E.B. Du Bois and put it in there.
Yeah. So we're going to run out of time, unfortunately. And of course, I would love to sit here and talk to you all day. But I do want to talk just a little about what you're working on now and what people will hear from you when you appear at the Midwest Literary Walk. That is at 1 p.m. on Saturday at the Main Street Church in Chelsea, Michigan. But what's next for you?
Well, you know, I'm working on, I'm really interested in another kind of figure that came up in the book, The Legacy of James Rhys Europe, who is probably one of the most important and also at the same time the least well-known jazz figure of the 20th century. James Rhys Europe led the Hellfighters band of the 369th. Into battle, and then at the same time had them touring around France playing jazz to Europeans for really the first time in history. So he also was responsible for building a kind of musicians union called the Clef Club. So he was a little bit like A. Philip Randolph and Duke Ellington combined, but he died tragically right after World War One, more or less.
And you're gonna write a book about him? Or?
I'm interested in him, and I'm also interested in Black Seminoles, who are really
that's really
basically a story of an entire nation of Black folks living in the swamps of Florida, who were entirely. Entirely independent, lived traded with the Seminole Nation, fought three separate wars against the British and the United States, had a treaty, moved out to Oklahoma, then moved down to Mexico, and that's just, I mean, come on.
No, I know it's an incredible story, and it's not been properly told in too many instances.
No.
All right. Well, Tayan Bajess is really, really wonderful to have you here on Detroit Today. And again, you can see Tayemba on Saturday, April 22nd at 1 p.m. at the Main Street Church in Chelsea, Michigan during the Midwest Literary Walk. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to do it for us. Come back. We're going to talk a little about the political consequences of the Dominion lawsuit settlement with Fox News. This is 101.9 WDETFM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again on Monday.